Well, last Sunday, as Jens reminded us a moment ago, we took a detour from our series we've been on, and we just talked about some words of Jesus, and they are about finding rest, like Jens was talking about finding rest in the Lord, and we talked about that last Sunday, and we won't rehash that sermon, but I want to show one verse that we saw last week before we get back into today's content. Last week, we read these words, Matthew 11:29, Jesus said, "Take my yoke upon you, let me teach you, because I am humble and gentle at heart, and you will find rest for your souls." We won't get into all of that verse again today. That was our last Sunday's detour message, so we won't readdress it all. But I wanted you to notice those words. Jesus said, "Let me teach you, because I am humble." We talked about the humility of Jesus and how he's shown, you know, instead of saying, "Do you know who I am? And your problems are your problems," he stepped into our need and helped us and humbled himself. And he says to us, "Take my yoke and come alongside of me and be humble too. And humble enough to be taught. Let me teach you." And the good news is, Jesus said, "I'm humble and I'm gentle. This is the easy way to learn." And that's a great statement, because I want to put this on the screen for you. The truth is that you can learn one of two ways. You can learn the easy way or the hard way in life, right? But either way, we're going to learn. And that's just true for all of our lives, for me, for you, for all of us, as long as we live. We can always learn the easy way or the hard way. It starts when we're very young and you're a toddler and your parents tell you, "Hey, no, don't take that fork and pry off the safety cap covering the light socket and put the fork inside there, because that's not going to end well." And you got to decide, do my parents care about me and are they trying to help me, or are they just jerks trying to keep me from having any fun, right? And what you do with that information will determine how you learn about electricity. That there's an easy way or a hard way. And our whole lives go like that. No matter how old we get, as teenagers, as young adults, as middle-aged and older people, we can continually learn the easy way or the hard way. We can approach life with a teachable spirit or not. And it's a beautiful life when we're teachable, when we can take input from life or from others, when we can even take correction and not consider it to be hostile because it's helpful. When we can not just listen to input or correction, but when we can read and learn and explore the frontiers of our ignorance, when we can challenge our assumptions about how things go in life, even when we're sure we're right. Because as we learn and as we continue to grow, we can continue to grow. But being humble, Jesus said, "Look, let me teach you." That's the easy way. But it takes humility. And let's be honest, most of our mistakes in life and sins are laced with pride. Pride is at the root of it all. But humility is the counterside of that. And humility is a big idea. And just one aspect of humility, just one aspect, but an important aspect, is the idea of being teachable. That I want to keep learning. And I would rather learn the easy way than through experience. Someone says experience is the best teacher. I object. I don't think so. It's the most effective teacher, but it's certainly the more preferred teacher. I'd rather learn from somebody else's experience over that, or just some another way. So we can learn the easy way or the hard way. But either way, in life, we're going to learn. And Jesus said, "Let me teach you." So we're going to talk about that a little bit today. We're going to get back to our sermon series. If you're new today or online or in person and you've not been tracking with this, I want to just remind you, we've been taking a journey through the Bible for the last year and a half now. And it's a journey through the biblical narrative. And we started in what we call the Old Testament or the Old Covenant or the Hebrew story. And we made our way into a period of Israel's history where the kingdom was established and then it was divided. And when the kingdom was divided, it was divided north and south. The northern kingdom was known as Israel from that point, and the southern kingdom was known as Judah. And they never came together again. We called these lessons through the Bible, we're calling them thrones, because they're covering the thrones of the divided kingdom. And up north, they never had a single good king since they divided. It's been murders and assassinations and genocide and hostile takeovers. It's been a real bloodbath up north. In the south, it was pretty calm. It was always the ancestors of King David all the way down the line, except for the story that Anthony shared while I was gone 2 weeks ago, where for a short time, someone else sat on the throne by hostile takeover. But then they got rid of her, and then the throne was back to the descendants of King David. So we're continuing our Thrones series today, and we're moving our way towards the story of Jesus in a few months. We're going to get to the New Testament, the Christian writings later, but we're still journeying through the Old Covenant writings. And so in this part of Thrones today, I'm going to back up the truck and do a major unload. I want to apologize in advance if it's a lot of material. And if because it's a lot of material, I talk even faster than normal. I hope I don't, but I probably might. Because I'm going to drop a lot of material on you for the next little bit to keep the story moving. We're going to cover four kings of the south today. It's a 113-year time period today. Four kings. Now, for comparison, we've spent weeks and weeks on just the one kingdom of Ahab. One man's kingdom was like probably 8 weeks of material because of all the stories and prophets and other things that happened. Now we're going to cover four kings, 113 years, all today. So I'm just letting you know it's important because I know we're trying to give you the overall biblical narrative, and I want some of you who care about these details to know what happens. But we got to get to the next spot after today, so here it comes. The first one is a man whose name is Amaziah. We're going to see Amaziah and his son, grandson, and great-grandson. Amaziah was the son of King Joash, who Anthony spoke about a couple weeks ago. He was the young boy whose family was murdered when Athaliah, the daughter of Ahab and Jezebel up north, came to the south, married into the family. When her husband and her son died, she killed off the rest of the royal family, took the throne for 6 years, and at the age of seven, the kingdom revolted against her, put Joash as the child king in charge. He was a good king until he got older. He turned around and murdered the son of the man who helped him the most when he didn't like what he had to say. And then he went off a bad path. And in the end of Joash's life, he was wounded in battle. And then eventually, he was recovering on his bed when his own people came and executed him and he died. That's the backstory from 2 weeks ago. Here we go. Amaziah's his son. Here's what Amaziah did. When Amaziah became established as the new king, he killed the men who killed his father. He took them out of the picture. He did not kill their family members. People historically have sometimes gotten vengeance by wiping out whole families who hurt them. He did not do that. He just killed the men who killed his father because they did wrong. That was following the law of Moses in doing so. But then he decides to become a military guru. He wants to go to battle. So he decides to start a war with the Edomites. The Edomites were the descendants of Esau, who was the brother of Jacob or Israel, like 1,500 years earlier. They'd gone their separate ways, and they lived in some strongholds on the side of a mountain. Their capital city was built on cliff edges to where there was only one way to penetrate their city, so it was easier to guard on the cliffs there. And they were a powerful a nation, and Amaziah decides to go to war against them. To help him win the war, he wants to hire some extra help from other countries. He's going to pay some people to join his army for this campaign. That includes the people up north in the kingdom of Israel. The problem is, once he offers them the job and they're coming down to join him, a prophet of the Lord comes to Amaziah and says to him, do not make a unity pact with the kingdom of the north. Remember how your ancestor, your great-grandfather, Jehoshaphat, did that? And how that when he did that, that union with the north brought Ahab and Jezebel's family into the south and caused all the drama? It was a big mistake. Don't yoke up with them. But Amaziah said to the prophet, I've already promised to pay them. I can't not. It's too late. I've already promised to pay them to fight with me. And the prophet says, who cares? Just give them the money and send them home. You don't need them. You need God's help more than their help. Just let God take you in battle, you'll win. And Amaziah, to his credit, he listens. He says, okay. He makes a hard decision based upon good advice, and he decides to not take those helpers into battle. He still pays them because they came down. And by the way, what a good deal for them, right? They got paid to do nothing. It's like being the backup quarterback in the NFL. You just get to sit back and never get tackled, never get sacked, and still get paid. It's a wonderful idea. But, they're sent home. And that you think they'd be happy about that, but instead they were spiteful. They went on their way back to the north. They actually looted different villages and towns of Judah out of spite. I don't know why. But we'll deal with that later. Amaziah goes to battle against the Edomites. He wins a major military campaign. And it's a pretty cool story up to this point. Unfortunately, it goes bad from here. Amaziah, for some reason, something changes in him in this part of his life. I don't know what. He probably felt cocky because he took care of his father's killers. He won a campaign against the mighty Edomites. But something changes after he wins, and it's downhill from there. For example, this is a terrible detail. They had a bunch of prisoners of war from Edom. They took them to those cliff edges of their city, and they threw like 10,000 people off the cliffs to their death, soldiers. That's a very inhumane way to treat prisoners of war. It was just savage and brutality to the utter degree. And then, if that wasn't enough, it says in 2 Chronicles 25:14, when King Amaziah returned from slaughtering the Edomites, he brought with him idols taken from the people of Seir. Seir is also Edom. He set them up as his own gods, bowed down in front of them, and offered sacrifices to them. What a weird thing to do. He comes back with their idols that they made and says, I'm going to worship these now instead of the God of the universe. Israel was famous for worshiping the monotheistic, the creator of the world, the monotheistic deity, the God who made everything that they had a relationship with because God showed himself to their ancestors and they followed that idea of the creator, the God of all. And instead, you know, Amaziah decides to worship idols that someone made with their hands as his deity. And so this is a bad move. And it says in verse 15, this made the Lord very angry. He sent a prophet to ask him, hey, why do you turn to gods who could not even save their own people from you? That's a fair point, isn't it? Like, you know, really? Now, you'd think that at this point, Amaziah might just say, that's a good point. I'm going to listen. Because before, when he was confronted, he corrected. He listened. But not this time. Not this time. It says in verse 16, but the king interrupted the prophet and said to him, hey, since when have I made you the king's counselor? Be quiet before I have you killed. He's like, next time I want your opinion, I'll ask for it. Shut up or die. Which is what his father had done to somebody else, but now he didn't follow through. He just threatened. And the prophet is shocked to hear it. So the prophet stopped with this warning. He said, I know that God is determined to destroy you because you have done this and refused to accept my counsel. Now that's just prophet speak. That's prophet speak for a simple idea of him saying, Amaziah, a younger version of you was listening and growing as a person, but now you've gotten so full of yourself that you're not listening to any input anymore. And that's going to be your destruction, as it usually is for most people. And sure enough, it was. In fact, Amaziah at that point is feeling so cocky with his successes that he's already had that he decides to go start a fight with the kingdom of the north. Because after all, they raided his cities after he paid those guys to fight with him and sent them home. So he's going to start a fight with them. So in verse 17, it says, after consulting with his advisors, King Amaziah of Judah sent this challenge to Israel's king Jehoash, the son of Jehoahaz, the grandson of Jehu. Come and meet me in battle. Now, the grandson, Jehu, remember Jehu a few weeks ago? Jehu was the mighty general up north who wiped out the house of Ahab and took over the northern kingdom. He's long gone, but his grandson Jehoash is king. And Amaziah says to him, hey, come meet me in battle. I'm feeling pretty tough. Let's fight. I got a bone to pick with you. And Jehoash doesn't want to fight him. So he tries to intermediate with some peaceful talk. And in verse 18 says, but King Jehoash of Israel replied to King Amaziah of Judah with this story. Now, I'm going to read the story with you. It's a weird story. Well, it's weird to us because if you know anything about translating things in other languages, oftentimes idioms and jokes or cliches get lost in translation. It's true whether you're translating from Thai to English or English to French. It's just things get lost sometimes in translation. Ancient Hebrew is especially hard. And this story makes a little sense, but it's kind of odd. I'm just going to read it with you. Here's the story Jehoash gives Amaziah. He says, out in the Lebanon mountains, a thistle sent a message to a mighty cedar tree. Give your daughter in marriage to my son. But just then a wild animal of Lebanon came by and stepped on the thistle, crushing it. You're like, what? That's an interesting story you have there. Again, probably some of the nuance is not clear. Part of it's obvious. But what he's basically saying is, Amaziah, you're like a thistle, and I'm like a mighty cedar tree, and you're about to get crushed. But there's a little more to it that doesn't seem necessary, but again, we weren't there, it's old. I'm sure it made more sense at the time. But then he expounds on it further, because the next verse, Jehoash says, hey, you are saying I've defeated the Edomites, and you are very proud of it. Congratulations, but my advice is to stay at home. Why stir up trouble that will only bring disaster on you and on the people of Judah? Look, you're feeling all tough, but don't start something with me that you can't finish, because I'll have to finish it. And believe me, I won't start it, but I will finish. But Amaziah's not listening, is he? No one's going to tell him anything. He's the man right now. He's all right. Do you know who I am? Do you know who I am? I've done a lot, you know. So he's going to fight anyhow. And he loses bad. It's a bad outcome. It's funny to the people in the hallway, but it's a bad outcome for the rest of us. So here's what happens in verse 22. Judah was routed by the army of Israel, and its army scattered and fled for home. King Jehoash of Israel captured Judah's king Amaziah at Beth Shemesh. Then he brought him to Jerusalem, where he demolished 600 feet of Jerusalem's wall from the Ephraim gate to the corner gate. I'm going to just park there and talk about this whole scene. Amaziah is captured in battle. That's pretty awkward, because it's one thing when you're like a soldier get captured in battle and they're going to be like, tell us your name, rank, and serial number. But this is the king. He's a prisoner of war. That's pretty awkward. And now the king of the north is going to bring the king of the south as his prisoner back to the south to his capital and attack the capital. Imagine the people down south in Jerusalem. They're watching their soldiers return home, running back from battle, wounded, licking their wounds, and scared. And then a few minutes later, however long later, here comes the kingdom of the north that you just went to battle with, and they're showing up to your city with a big army to attack you. And they're all sitting there saying, oh no, what are we going to do? What are we going to do? Where's our king to lead us? Oh look, there he is. He's with the enemy as their prisoner watching helplessly. How awkward would it be to be like on the other side as the king, a captive, watching what they're about to do to your city? And sure enough, he walks in and he breaks about 600 feet of the wall down, which makes the city vulnerable. And then he brings the king Amaziah into his own city as a prisoner to make him watch what he's about to do next. This is so awkward. It says he carried off all the gold and silver and all the articles from the temple of God that had been in the care of Obed-Edom. He also seized the treasures of the royal palace along with hostages and returned to Samaria. He's like, you know what? We'll take the wealth of the temple, take the wealth of your palace. We'll take some people. Those are nice people. I want them. They belong to me now. I'll take them with me. And then he sets Amaziah free and says, okay, here's your kingdom back. What's left of it, you know? Here it is. I told you, I won't start it, but I'll finish it, and I'll make you pay for it, and you just paid for it. So carry on. And he goes home. It was a brilliant move for Jehoash, by the way, because do you think the kingdom of the south was going to attack the north again? They had a whole job to do now. They had to rebuild their wall. When your wall's broken down, you're vulnerable to anybody. So that's project number one, and that's going to take a long time. But then, they're not going to mess with the north. Jehoash made a very strong point when he went back home. And poor Amaziah's there with his people saying, hey guys, I'm back. So, that didn't go well, did it? Whoops, I guess I should have listened to somebody. And it weakened his leadership so bad, it denigrated him so bad that he never recovered. That while they rebuilt the city, his leadership suffered from his failures. Trust was gone, and eventually, just like happened to his dad, he was killed. It says in 2 Kings, we're going to move over from Chronicles to Kings for this detail. The stories are similar, but they have different details. 2 Kings 14:19 says, there was a conspiracy against Amaziah's life in Jerusalem. He fled to Lachish, but his enemies sent assassins after him, and they killed him there. They brought his body back to Jerusalem on a horse. He was buried with his ancestors in the city of David. What a sad ending. To a man who started off well, but then he got cocky and quit listening to anybody. Well, then, once he's gone, his son Uzziah became the next king. Uzziah is a 16-year-old boy who's now thrown into the throne of the kingdom. That's a young age. Now, I want to just say a few things about Uzziah today. Uzziah is one of the best kings Israel ever has for the well-being of the nation. He is going to have a 52-year reign. Of our 113 years we're covering today, he's 52 of them himself. He has an amazing kingdom. He makes them so strong. This is literally going to be a golden era of Judah. And I'm not going to give it the time and the attention that it deserves today. For some people, they lived their entire lives under Uzziah's reign or the reign of his son after him. It was a golden era. This was as strong as Israel has ever been since the kingdom was first divided. Judah was ever since the division. Uzziah is awesome, and we're not going to give him the attention he deserves today. We're going to move the story along. Let me read a few details to you before we continue. It says in chapter 26 of 2 Chronicles, starting with verse 9, that Uzziah built fortified towers in Jerusalem at the corner gate, at the valley gate, and at the angle in the wall. This is the part of the city that got broken down when his father got defeated. He doesn't just rebuild the wall, he makes it stronger than ever. He learns from his father's failures about how to be in better shape than Israel was or than Judah was before him. He also, verse 10, constructed forts in the wilderness, and he dug many water cisterns because he kept great herds of livestock in the foothills of Judah and on the plains. He was also a man who loved the soil. He had many workers who cared for his farms and vineyards, both on the hillsides and in the fertile valleys. He was a man of the earth. He was a man of war. Uzziah is truly the total package, and I wish we could give him more time than just a few minutes here. I'm going to give him this extra push because I want those of you who care about this history timeline to know his name, even though we're not going to spend much time here. But he's awesome. Like, national leaders, even to this day, some national leaders are known for being great with foreign policy but weak domestically, or they're good with domestic policy but they're weak in other areas. Uzziah was great at all of it. Agriculturally, the land flourished. Militarily, they fought battles and wars, they won. He knew who to fight, who not to fight, when to do it, how to do it. He knew how to build the defense mechanisms to where they would not lose in the future. And it was really a golden era for 52 beautiful years of his reign. In fact, it goes on to say in verse 14 that Uzziah provided the entire army with shields, spears, helmets, coats of mail. Now, coats of mail refers to a certain kind of body armor called chain mail sometimes, or link mail. Some of you nerds who like this kind of stuff know what I'm talking about. Sadly, I'm one of them. It's a certain kind of body armor you'd wear underneath your clothing that would deflect certain attacks from hurting you. And he gave his men these tools, bows and sling stones. Sling stones refers more to like almost like catapult devices that would throw rocks. In fact, it goes on to say in verse 15 that he built structures on the walls of Jerusalem that were designed by experts to protect those who shot arrows and hurled large stones from the towers and the corners of the wall. So he is inventive. Like, he put serious money into research and development as a nation. And they get some state-of-the-art equipment. They have the best technology of the time to protect. And a lot of these are protective tools, so as soldiers feel safer in battle, so as people feel safer at home. He is truly a remarkable leader on every single front. And I feel like I'm skipping all of that too quickly, especially because I've got to tell you one bad story about him towards the end of his life. And it feels unfair to take 52 awesome years and tell his bad story longer than his good story. But so goes our series today. Towards the end of his reign, Uzziah got pretty cocky himself. I mean, he had good reason to be. He was amazing, truly amazing. But he got full of himself, and one day he goes to the temple of the Lord. The temple was a place where the people would come to worship God since they came out of slavery in Egypt a thousand years earlier. The temple was the permanent version of that. And in the temple, there was a special room called the Most Holy Place where the Ark of the Covenant was kept. And there was certain other spots where the priests did certain jobs in the main part of the temple with different, they would offer sacrifices that people would bring. They would offer incense, which is like a perfume, a fragrance to God. And that was their job. The priests and the Levites would do that. But the problem was Uzziah walks in and says, I don't need someone to do that for me. I don't need some, I can do it myself. I'm the king. You know, who needs the these priests as if they can do the job for me? I don't need to be under their care. He hid his pride for some weird reason. See, in the kingdom, he was the man and the priest submitted to his kingship. But in the temple, that was their job, that was their specialty. But he had a hard time respecting their specialty because of who he was. He said, I don't need anyone else to do it for me. I can do it for myself. Am I not the king? You know? So he grabs the incense and says, I'm going to offer it myself. And the priests, like, get in his way. And they're like, no, king, we love you, but you're making a big mistake. Don't do this. And he's furious. He rages. It says that he's, like, yelling at them, am I not the king? You know? Do you know who I am? Do you know who I am? We pick up the story in verse 19. Uzziah, who was holding an incense burner, became furious. But as he was standing there raging at the priest before the incense altar in the Lord's temple, leprosy suddenly broke out on his forehead. Folks, leprosy, that's the big L. That's the disease of the day. It's highly contagious normally and incurable barring a miracle. And all of a sudden, he has an outbreak of it right here in this moment while he's having a fit. I mean, possibly based upon his father and grandfather, going to kill some people for insulting his, you know, his kingship. And now all of a sudden, he has an outbreak of leprosy. And it says that in the next verse that when Azariah the high priest and all the other priests saw the leprosy, they rushed him out. And the king himself was eager to get out because the Lord had struck him. So King Uzziah had leprosy until the day he died. He lived in isolation in a separate house, for he was excluded from the temple of the Lord. He had to be social distancing the rest of his life because of his leprosy. And I know that if you're reading that with me and you're tracking with me today, you're like, Arlen, if what you're saying is true, that Uzziah was this awesome king for 52 years, amazing era of Israel under his leadership, he makes this one mistake, this one bad mess up in pride, and he gets leprosy. It just seems so harsh, doesn't it, Arlen? I'm going to agree with you. It's uncomfortable for me, too. I'm just reading the story. I didn't write the story. I'm just passing it on to you, okay? I don't know, but there's probably more nuance than this recap right here. Would you imagine? There's probably more nuance to what happened than this history recap. But for some reason, he kind of changed. Once he had been so awesome, and then he got full of himself, and no one could do anything for him or tell him anything, and he wrecked himself. Now, whatever we think of the story, here's the bottom line that all of us can learn from, no matter how young or old we are. That in our life, it's just so true, isn't it? That people can be so awesome at a whole bunch of things in life. And this one area that we get stubborn about or we won't listen can actually hurt us so much to damage the other areas that we're good at. How many people have you known, or maybe it's happened to you along the way, where one area that we were negligent or stubborn about caused us to damage all the things that we were good at by a domino effect? And it's so important that we stay humble. No matter how good we are, we're not perfect and we're not arrived, and we should never dig our heels in and be unteachable. But unfortunately, Uzziah has a bad ending, and it's just what it is. In fact, it says in the last part of this verse that his son Jotham was put in charge of the royal palace, and he governed the people of the land. So Jotham is in the palace meeting with the team, the cabinet, so to speak. He's meeting with the people. His dad is in isolation because of his condition. So Jotham is kind of the public figure leader, but Uzziah is still the king behind the scenes. There's the front-facing leader, then there's the real leader behind the scenes. That's what's going on until eventually Uzziah dies from his leprosy. And then Jotham becomes the full-on king. And to be honest, Jotham is one of the best kings ever. Jotham is incredible. In fact, we'll read a couple of verses about him too. In 2 Chronicles 27, 2, Jotham did what was pleasing in the Lord's sight. He did everything his father Uzziah had done, except that Jotham did not sin by entering the temple of the Lord. What that is saying is he was able to learn from his father's good and continue it, but also learn from his father's bad and do better. And that's hard sometimes to do. We tend to take people as, you know, very just blanket statement, they're good or they're bad, you know. If you have people you admire in life, maybe it's a political leader, or maybe it's a cultural iconic person, or maybe it's just someone in your personal life. When we have people that we like, we want to defend them all the time. Like, everything they do must be awesome. But the truth is, it's probably not always, you know, I mean, there's probably bad too, right? If we're being honest and not defending their faults. On the other side, there's people we don't like in culture or politics or culture or in our life. We want to dismiss them completely. They're all bad. Even their good is bad. We just want to cancel them. And that's also foolish. And Jotham does the hard work of looking at his father's reign and saying, look at all the good he did. I want to continue those policies and be as good in those areas and better. But I also want to look at his failures honestly and learn from them and be well-rounded. And he does it. He's not as epic as Uzziah. Uzziah is truly one of the most epic kings in all of Judah's history, though we skipped over it for the most part. But Jotham is all around a better man and takes the kingdom to the next level. It does say at the end of that verse that the people continued in their corrupt ways. What does that mean? It just means that though he was a good king, the people of the land weren't always as devout in their faith as he was. We get that, don't we? In any part of the world today, a nation could have a great leader, but a lot of the people could be on a bad track morally. Or a nation could be full of good people in the nation with a bad leader. That could go either way. And Jotham is a great leader, but the land is kind of going the wrong direction. But not him. Verse 6 says that King Jotham became powerful because he was careful to live in obedience to the Lord his God. This was a golden era in Judah. Uzziah, great king for 52 years. Jotham, a phenomenal successor after Dad. And then we come to our fourth and final king today. We're moving right along, aren't we? The last guy. Unfortunately, his story is not so pretty. In fact, it's terrible. His name is Ahaz. And Ahaz, as nicely as I can put it, is an idiot. In 2 Chronicles 28, verse 1, it says, Ahaz was 20 years old when he became king, and he reigned in Jerusalem for 16 years. He did not do what was pleasing in the sight of the Lord, as his ancestor David had done. Now, just to make a point about that, remember, Israel had an understanding that there was a God, a monotheistic deity, a creator of all the world, that was both powerful and personal, and they had been in a relationship with him since God reached out to Abraham, their ancestor, and they were plugged into the God of all creation. But some people didn't do that, and Ahaz, that's been guiding their nation all along, but Ahaz rejects it. He's like, I want no part of that. I have no use for that. The problem with rejecting God is you also reject God's ways. And when we abandon God's ways, we abandon his, can I say it, best practices. Right? The God who made everything knows how things work best. And so he abandons God and he abandons best practices because of that. And it's going to bring him down a dark path. In fact, we can continue in verse 2. It says, instead, he followed the example of the kings of Israel. He cast metal images for the worship of Baal. Now, Baal worship, you've been around for a while with us in this series. You know, since the Israelites came from slavery through the wilderness, Baal worship has been a bane of their existence. Then tempting their people into its practices. So idols they make with their hands and worship as deities, and they did not have good practices. They were vulgar. We've discussed that before. We won't get into that today. This stuff has ruined the kingdoms of the north. Ahab and his family, it has caused so much trouble, and now Ahaz is worshiping it. Of all the vile practices of Baal worship, here's one example, verse 3, ready? It says, he offered sacrifices in the valley of Ben-Hinnom, even sacrificing his own sons. This is terrible. Even sacrificing his own sons in the fire. This is part of the religious cult of Baal worship. They would have child sacrifice. Who would even think about child sacrifice being acceptable or tasteful in any culture, right? It's gross. It's wicked. Let alone your own offspring. Now, kings back then were known to have a lot of children because they had lots of women. They could have anyone they wanted. They had lots of affairs. It's good to be the king, they would say, right, or something like that. So they had lots of babies running around somewhere. But for him to take his offspring, no matter how many he had, and say, I'm going to burn my sons in the fire in this religious practice that I'm involved in, is detestable. It's gross. But that's how far he's gone from wholesome leadership and living. In this way, he followed the detestable practices of the pagan nations the Lord had driven from the land ahead of the Israelites. It was a very dark time in Israel. Here's the crazy part, a little fill in the gap here. While he's lost in his own degrading behaviors, his kingdom is falling apart and he's not paying any attention. Almost like someone who's got a drug addiction or an alcohol addiction or just plays, you know, is a leader who plays video games all day and doesn't take care of their country. I don't know. He just ignores everything important to do this stuff. And while he's doing his thing, the nation's falling apart. The Arameans attack Judah, and they just steal property, steal cities, conquer people, they plunder them. The northern kingdom of Israel attacks them as well, and they plunder them further. And Ahaz finally is told, snap out of it and do something, but he doesn't know what to do because he's not been trying. So he decides to hire some outside help, and he hires the king of Assyria. Now, I've got to take a couple of minutes to mention the king of Assyria to you because we've not met him yet, but he's going to be very important in the near future. So let me tell you about Assyria. Assyria was the upcoming world power of the moment. It was a conglomeration of kingdoms that formed together as one giant kingdom under a leader who was going to like be a new world power. It was not right next to Judah, like the Arameans who were attacking them were right next to them. The northern kingdom was right next to them. But a little further to the northeast was the Assyrian Empire forming a superpower. Now, there was another superpower for a long time in the past to the southwest of them. That was Egypt. But Egypt was kind of fading. It was a fading star. And Assyria was a rising star. And so Ahaz thinks, I'm going to hire the Assyrians to come and help me beat up my bullies. They can come bully my bullies, you know. I'm going to hire them to come and fight my battle for me. So he sends word and money to them. And the king of Assyria does indeed show up, but it does not go as Ahaz hoped it would. It says in verse number 20, when King Tiglath-Pileser of Assyria arrived, he attacked Ahaz instead of helping him. Whoops. He's like, you know what? I don't want to help you. Thanks for the money, but I see why they pick on you now. I think I'm going to join the crowd. You look easy to bully. So they just decides to clobber them more. I mean, he can't win for losing. Every direction he turns, they're just beating him down. Ahaz took valuable items from the Lord's temple, from the royal palace, and from the house of his officials, next verse here, and gave them to the king of Assyria as tribute. He robs his own people, said, hey, we got to pay this guy off to leave us alone. But it did not help him. He has lost everything. And he's so weakened. You think at this point he'd start saying, what am I doing wrong? Maybe I should turn to God in my desperate hour, right? No way. He's stubborn. He refused to buckle down. He buckled down. In verse 22, it says, even during this time of trouble, King Ahaz continued to reject the Lord. Verse 23, he offered sacrifices to the gods of Damascus who had defeated him. For he said, well, since these gods helped the kings of Aram, they will help me too if I sacrifice to them. His logic is, the Arameans are tougher than me, so I'll worship their gods because they're tougher than mine. That sounds logical. Except for it's not accurately applied because he hasn't been following the God of creation that Israel's been worshiping at all. In fact, he's abandoned that his whole way through. And it's one of those deals where you're like, that sounds logical until you think it through. He's doing what human beings have always done, haven't we? Human beings are so good at, instead of taking the truth and letting it lead us to where we need to get to and cause us to change what needs to be changed, we're good at taking it and twisting it and spinning it to support our narrative and what we want to do, to fit our desires. And he says, I know, logically, I can make it fit to where the logical thing to do is to worship these idols of the people of Damascus. It says in this verse, but instead they led to his ruin and the ruin of all Judah. Here's the saddest verse, and this is how stubborn and he always was, but this is how bad he was. Refused to budge on what he wanted, no matter how much life tried to teach him. This last verse, I'm going to read one more verse, and we're done reading verses today. But this last verse will be in three pieces, and it's so massive that if I've lost your attention, sit back up straight, slap yourself, slap your neighbor, whatever you need to do, because this last part is really shocking if you stop to think about it. In verse 24, it says this, the king took the various articles from the temple of God and broke them into pieces. Now, that's not the wealth. The wealth's already been sucked away to pay off his enemies to leave him alone. This is taking the actual furniture that causes the temple to exist and function and breaking it into pieces so it's no longer usable. Then, part two, it says he shut the doors of the Lord's temple so that no one could worship there. Now, folks, this is a big moment. Since the tabernacle was first established back in the wilderness, since King David first brought the tabernacle into Jerusalem, the capital city, since the temple under Solomon's reign was built as a permanent house to replace it, it has always been in operation for centuries and centuries and centuries now, for 1,000 years now, actually. Or not quite that, but it's been a long time. It's been in operation. And some of the kings were not faithful men. They were not devout religious people. But they always let the temple be there for all the people who wanted it. In fact, when the kingdom divided, people moved from the north to the south just to be close to the temple because it was a part of the nation's identity. And for the first time in 1,000 years, the king says, I have no interest in it and no one else will either. I'm shuttering the doors. It was such a powerful moment that it would have rocked the whole nation to its core to have the door shuttered and locked. And then it says in the last part of the verse that he set up altars to pagan gods in every corner of Jerusalem. He says, this is what I'm worshiping. You all go here and worship these things if you want to worship something, but the temple is no longer available. It was shocking. And Ahaz just kept doubling down. And in the end, we won't read the story, but in the end, he dies after a short 16-year reign, and no one was sorry when he was gone. He died without celebration of his life. He was buried like his funeral service was probably quoted by Yzma from The Emperor's New Groove. She's like, well, he ain't getting any deader, and they went on with their lives like nothing happened, right? I mean, it was over, rover. And that's where we're going to stop today. His son is going to be left with a mess to fix. We're going to get to his son down the road a ways in a couple weeks. But let me tell you what's going to happen next week before I wrap this one up with a couple of statements. Next week, we're going to leave the south and head back to the northern kingdom to see the end of the northern kingdom. Within 2 weeks of our next two Sundays, the northern kingdom is going to be gone for good. I don't mean the fall of the house of Ahab like we saw a few weeks ago. I mean the northern kingdom is going to be gone forever, ultimately destroyed. And we'll see. Next week, we're going to see a famous Bible story. Won't be like today where I dumped the whole truck on you. It's going to be one story next week that's pretty famous. We'll study that. We'll learn from that. It's well known. And then we're going to get to the spot where the kingdom of the north is gone forever. So that'll be huge. Before today, I just want to leave you with a couple thoughts that we started with. We were reminded at the beginning of the importance of being teachable. Like Jesus said, when Jesus said, let me teach you. I'm gentle, I'm humble. This is the easy way, or you can learn the hard way. The importance of being teachable in life. And here's why it's so important. I'm going to give you two statements. Here's the first one. You can't reach your potential if you think you've already arrived. We understand that, right? We can never reach our potential if we think we've already arrived. I mean, who could help? It doesn't matter how old we are. It could be young and then make, nope, I know what I want, who I am. Just leave me alone. Or it could be we're middle-aged or old. I'm done. I've come far enough. And that's our decision. Although I never want to get to the spot where I'm so old that I put a cap on myself. As long as we're alive, we can keep growing. If we stop growing, we start dying. And every day of life I have is a chance to be a better person, to learn more, to develop something in my life. But the minute you think you've arrived, it's a cap on you. You can't reach your potential if you think you've already arrived. It's like working out with weights or building muscles. I like to build muscle, as you could tell. I mean, I don't want to flex and rip this shirt off and embarrass everybody, but it's a pretty remarkable physique going on here. But anyhow, but when you build muscle, I wish you wouldn't laugh when I say things like that. It hurts my feelings. When someone's building muscle, what happens? They have to tear down, they have to work out and kind of rip their muscles up to rebuild them, to build back stronger, right? That's kind of how it goes when you're working out. You kind of get to it. It's painful. And then you're sore for a few days, and then you get stronger. Now, when someone's building muscle, they can get to a spot in their journey where they say, that's enough. I don't want to get any stronger. This is far enough. I'm happy with where I've built to. I don't need to be Arnold Schwarzenegger or Arlen Walters. I don't need to be like that. I don't want to go there. I just want to be, this is good enough. And so they stop. You know why? Because at that point in their life, it's not worth the pain of tearing down or ripping up their muscles to build back stronger. It's not worth it anymore. This is good enough. I'm going to stop here. And that's fine for building muscle, but when it comes to life, life doesn't stop coming at us. And the day we say, ah, I'm good enough, I'm content, no matter how young or old we are, that's far enough. I don't want to go through the tear down or the ripping up of my ideas or my behaviors. I don't want to learn anything. I don't want to have any input. I definitely don't want any correction, and I don't want to be challenged. I don't want to go and learn things I don't know and challenge my assumptions and go through the pain and discomfort of growing because I'm good enough. You can't go any further, and you can't reach your potential when you think you've already arrived. And I'm suggesting, no matter how old you are, keep living and keep growing. Now, simple last statement. This is not a complicated statement. It's so simple, but I hope that somebody here will take this to heart because it will help you. As unsensational as it may sound, it will help you down the road. And that is this. Reaching the next level means learning the next lesson. It's as simple as that. Reaching the next level means learning the next lesson. I can't go any further if I'm sure I've already arrived, and I'm done listening, I know enough. There's always a lesson. And to get to the next level, you've got to be willing to learn it. You've got to be willing to grow and stretch yourself. And I hope that all of us today would be the kind of people that would say, I want to be teachable, I want to learn in life, and I want to learn the easy way, not the hard way, and I want to grow. And if you'll do that in your marriage, in your relationships, in your leadership, if you're a leader, in your personal life, in your business, if you have a business, I believe the sky can be the limit, but we'll put a cap on that potential once we think we've arrived. We saw kings today who got to a spot where they were so full of their own successes that they stopped growing and they started making bad choices. And we have people like Jotham who said, I'll never stop learning at all. And we have people like Ahaz who never started learning in the first place. But in the end, you can't reach your potential if you think you've already arrived. And reaching the next level means learning the next lesson. We're going to stop there a little later than usual because I had to throw 113 years at you today. But we're slowing down next week. Famous Bible story next week. It'll be fun, I hope. And then the end of the Northern Kingdom forever. But for today, let's pray.